questions here. One is related to the non-dualism we discussed before. That's the idea of the non-dual, deny the existence of God. Non-dualism and monism will keep in our mind at the moment. And then I said I was going to clarify the difference between ideation, mentation and form. And we have a question here about architecture and the significance of particular architectural forms and an attempt to extend consciousness, the application of general laws, methods from which you may expect good results. We'll try and telescope all these together, I think. We want some general methods of extending consciousness. We want the relation between dualism, non-dualism, and monism. And something to do with the significance of architectural forms. We'll start with a circle, I think. When we use the compasses, I hope the sticks in the middle, it usually falls out, I think. When we draw a line closing itself in this manner, we have apparently created something. The word create, C-R-K, C and K are interchangeable, hard C and T. The root of it is the tiny root kra, which read Hebraica is ark. And in order to create, we have to circumscribe. And without circumscription, we cannot create. The two terms are interchangeable. In the process of drawing the circle, we have apparently excluded the paper outside the circle, and we have included paper within the circle. So we say that the circumscription simultaneously includes and excludes. But if we imagine this paper to extend infinitely, endlessly, then outside the form there is no further form. And inside it, the paper can be considered to be a zone internal to which all formulation must take place. Now we have ideation. This is the word that the Greeks use for form, and the Latin word form, and the other word mentation used by Gurdjieff. And we're going to talk about the relation of these three, ideation, form and mentation, in relation to this circumscription. F changes to P, the R is constant here, and if we remember the pi ratio, which is at the basis of all circumscription, form essentially refers to the circumscribed. And we said this was a Latin word, and that the Latins were concerned with dominion. When we talk about empire, empira, the pi ra, or ratio function of this circle, is the same root we find in piracy, an empire. Here is the central authority, and the limit of empire is the limit of the authority, and it's the same as the radius of the circle. All form is simply the circumscription of a zone internal to which activities are going to take place. Outside the formed, we cannot discuss. Discuss means strike, causes strike, usually precedes striking, but it means strike, causes strike, cause. This is two. Discuss implies duality. If we don't draw anything outside this circle, another circle, we can't discuss. To discuss, we must have two entities and strike them together and get a result. When we're talking about form, if we say this circle represents the form than which there is no bigger, imagine a circle than which there is no bigger, and call it God, as one of the theologians said. The form is the O, the circumscription, the rotation of this radius round. If we imagine here that we have a positive charge and here a negative charge, and the negative charge rushes rapidly round, as in a hydrogen atom, if it runs round so quickly that no external entity could get across its orbit before it had time to come round and knock it out, that zone would be opaque or solid to a being attempting to invade it. Solidity is velocity. And the O in form is this O, and the F, which is the P, is here in the middle. The P propagated is F for force, and as far as that goes, as far as it goes, if you like, up to the limits of the substance that it dominates, is form. So form is a posited force ordering a substance. The fundamental idea is the ordering of a substance by a positing force. In the word idea, we have a concept id, which is the same as the English word it, and air, which occurs in earth. This is the fundamental substantial aspect of the universe, the goddess, the passive aspect. This is the intellective aspect that analyzes it. So to the Greek, idea meant that by which the substance is analyzed. And there's no consideration in the word idea for this pi ratio function, which has to do with the psychological bias of the Romans to dominate up to a certain limit. So the word idea is an analytical idea. It's a concept of cutting into things regardless of their shape. It would produce an idea if you took a stick and cut it into bits, the idea of parts of the stick. But when we consider the form of the stick, we have to consider it as occupying a certain amount of space. So that the word idea became more naturally limited to mental processes, because we can cut things in the mind without them being three-dimensional. And we tend to use the word form for external things, because of the circumscription, the limiting factor. Now, mentation is from the root ma, to measure, and you see the men in here. Man is so called because he measures, and the T in here and the T here symbolize the crossing of the forces in the mind, which crossings are what is meant by mentation. One idea cuts across another and in the process analyzes it. If I put the word dog down here and cat down here, the two interact in a certain way and generate an idea of animal out of them. And we begin to understand them when we find a category higher than both, which includes both. If I say a knife into a piece of French bread or something, that's another mode of analysis. And when I'm doing this in the mind, I take the idea of knife and put it on the idea of bread. And the idea of bread involves it being softer than the idea of the steel blade. So knife into bread goes cut. Bread into knife doesn't go. And this process of lapping ideas over in the mind is called mentation. And it simply means the evaluating, the counting of the ideas, which are the forms in the mind. Gurdjieff is fond of using this word, although it's an ordinary dictionary word, because it wasn't very popular. And he wanted to impart a little stimulus to the mind to consider things in a different way. If he'd have merely said the thinking process, people would have thought that they knew what he meant. Whereas in using this word, although it's a dictionary word, he was using something that isn't so very, very popular, and therefore they had to try to think what mentation was, instead of assuming that they knew. The Italian word for a city is città, and that word is derived from and is identical with the Sanskrit città, which means a city. And if you look at this map, this will bring us round to the architecture again, in this particular city, every cell in the brain has sent a message, regardless, just radiating from its own center outwards, and every other cell has sent a message, and there's no order in it, there's no town planning. Consequently, the whole thing is confused. We can't see the structure of that city. It's higgledy-piggledy. There's no order. To make order, we must O-R-D. O is a circle. R is a letter that means differentiation. D means division. We must divide according to the natural tendency to differentiate. If we divide an apple unintelligently, we can do it by putting it in a mango. And if we had only one apple and never opened it before and put it through the mango, we wouldn't know much about the internal structure of the apple. But if we take a knife and cut the apple through, we'll see something like this in the middle. And there'll be a skin there, and then a pulpy stuff, then a hard bit, and then some seeds. Now that kind of analysis means that the apple is already differentiated. There is a skin, different degree of hardness in that, protective, a soft pulpy stuff, then a hard bit again for the seeds. And the differentiation internal to the apple has already been accomplished by nature. So then we begin to divide it according to the natural divisions. When we take the entity, that's O, is the apple, we look at the way it has been differentiated by nature, and then we divide all the different things carefully on their natural lines of cleavage, then we've made an intelligent analysis. And we are beginning to introduce order because we're looking for natural lines of cleavage. You can analyze a man's leg with a chopper very, very quickly. But it doesn't improve your knowledge of the way the arteries and things run down. You couldn't really study nervous physiology with an X. Schopenhauer didn't. And it made him pessimistic. So in the introduction of order, we have to take the entity, see the natural divisions, the differentiation tendencies of its different parts, put them into categories, divide them on lines of natural cleavage. Then we make another kind of mental pattern. Instead of having a higgledy-piggledy with all the cells broadcasting their own particular messages, we set up a central concept. The central concept that all order depends on circumscription, that there is a force active, entering and dividing, and there is the substance of the thing itself, passive, being divided. This is our central concept. We put that inside the mind. Here's the gentleman's skull. And we make it the same size as the skull, and then we proceed on the basis of this to order. To draw more of them. Here's one in the front, here's a zone in the middle, and here's another one in the back. And we keep on doing this all over. When we put the circle in and quarter it, which is the meaning of the mandala of the Indians, we are introducing order into what would otherwise be a very confused force relation. So this concept of idea is simply an entity by means of which we cut into things and separate them. The idea of form is a circumscribed zone, substantial, differentiated by a force. Mentation is a serial process of introducing order into the system. And if we have a control concept, we can introduce a lot of order in a relatively short space of time. Now we have to tie this to the idea of development. It isn't enough for us to get the man's head and put in his forebrain there, the control concept. There's a gentleman smiling because he's got a control concept. We've got to get it down, the spinal column, through the emotional self, yes and no, into the volitional center. And then, if we're lucky, it might make the legs walk. And it might even, at the emotional level, conjure up some executive powers. The essential thing is, when we've got the control concept, to begin to apply it. And the only way to apply an idea is first to emote about it. We can't make an idea as such work unless we feel. We must feel very, very strongly that we're for this idea, or very strongly that we're against the idea. If we want to build a new building in town centre, we must be against the existing building. Otherwise, we're not going to build a new one. And when we felt very, very strongly, then we pushed the energy down into the volitional centre. And from there, a reaction starts and builds backwards. And the eyes and the ears and so on will begin to look and to listen and get data from outside in the line of the willed direction. So the application of the governing concept must go through emotion into volition. We can't do it any other way, consciously. And a child, when it's born, starts the other way. When it's born, when it's extruded from the mother, it is a willful being. William Blake says he came out into the dangerous world, hot and piping wild, and then began to sulk on his mother's breast because he didn't like the passage into this world. He was a volitional being. That volitional being just wants or goes to sleep. The baby doesn't have any nose, not once, when it's born. It simply has a want or it goes to sleep. So the first stage of the baby is, I am wanting something to drink or I am sleeping. And if it were given simply something to drink and allowed to sleep, it would do so. And it would not become at a much higher level. But there are various forces acting upon the child. There are forces inherent in the form, in the germplasm in the child, which are already trying to force the child onto another level, and there are the forces of the parents acting upon the child to change its nappy and so on, and these constitute an interruption to the spontaneous volition of the child. And consequently, the child wakes up, has a drink of milk that gives pleasure, sends another message down, have another drink of milk and so on. When there's enough in here, it is called satisfied, full, and it goes to sleep and digests. But there comes a time when the child, in the middle of its sleep, by a well-trained, civilized mother, is wakened up because it has a theory imposed upon the parent about feeding times. So the spontaneous sleeping process of the child is interrupted and it's made to rise in consciousness. This will is not individually conscious. It is then forced up, and because it's been acted upon from outside and its own spontaneous rhythm broken, it passes into screaming, negating. And on being wakened by this externally derived order, the negation then climbs up into the head, and the eyes look round to see what has caused the interruption. The child then finds it is the mother, and the mother then proceeds to begin to feed it. The child's position is then ambivalent. It has an attitude towards the mother, and that mother has interrupted me. She's a horrible beast. And also, mother is now feeding me. She's wonderful. This duality of the child's attitude to the parents is going to last the rest of its life, and to extend to other beings too. All beings will be categorized according to the numbers of pleasures they induced, and the number of interferences with the spontaneous volition of the child. But the child is raising itself in consciousness only because it is being interfered with. To raise the child from the merely volitional level through the emotive into the rational requires quite an amount of energy input from outside and from the germplasm. Now we have two centers here. We call this horizontal one coming in the tradition of man going down and imposing the theory of feeding times, and coming straight through here, the germ plasm, the ancestral motive non-external, embodied in it, and then from here, vertically coming straight down, the forces that would have been called astrological once upon a time, we can call them cosmic forces today because we know that they exist, forces of radiation from outside the solar system, from the solar system itself, And they're all coming in and influencing by changing the rhythmic pattern inside the child's body. There are many forces at work on an individual. The most important one at the stage of the child is this ancestral one coming through the germplasm that makes it eat and sleep. The next one here is the parental one, which comes from tradition, imposing on it and forcing it through pain into mentation. And continuously this cosmic one is coming down and disposing the body in certain rhythms which are not individually determined. We'll examine these later on because they're very important. The important thing to consider here now is that we have a volitional centre which is non-individuated. There's no div in it. That belongs up there. Div, the divine division, the Diu, or God, the same deal, it doesn't matter how you spell it, unless you want to be very specific about the application, is the same as the videre to see. It is this part that does the seeing, and therefore the volitional level down here is not individual. It is aware of its purpose, but it is not aware that it is aware. It is simply a surging towards unverbalized objects. Later when we come to examine consciousness and awareness, we'll find the word awareness is more valuable for us than consciousness, because the word awareness is vaguer in significance than consciousness. Consciousness is more precise and belongs to the intellective rather than to the volitional. Here then we have a unity which is non-individuated. There's a oneness in it because it is a vehicle. And outside this circle is an infinite ocean of power which is pressing through the germplasm and activating here, but the push is coming from outside and there's no centre of reciprocation individual there. So it always comes in here that it is positive, and it climbs up from this monistic level into a dualism of liking and disliking. And the things that it likes are the things it can assimilate, and the things it dislikes are the things it cannot assimilate. And the things that it likes it calls good, and the things that it dislikes it calls bad. And that is the meaning of the fall. In the eating of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, the fault in man is to think that the pleasant is the good and the evil is the bad. Whereas, in fact, both these presuppose each other, and the very thing that we call bad is an essential of the thing we call good. The front of the body is good. See, there's a nice man. Nice front to the body, that's good. Good hand on the tummy, nice and soft. The head, the skull there is very, very hard, and the spine down the back is hard. So all this front part has to do with the good, as they say in the other man. The good little life here is the good. And it's comfortable. Whereas the bones in the spine are very uncomfortable. A gentleman with a very thin girlfriend thinks not so good. This part of the body, the spine, the bony part, we would say astrologically, is saturnine, compressive. And this part that swells out nicely on the newborn babe, put your legs on top of it. This part is the Jupiter part of it. But Jupiter and Saturn, or expansion and contraction, presuppose each other. So if this Saturnine is called evil by dualists, and this Jupiter is called good by dualists, it simply means that they have eaten of that tree of knowledge of good and evil and not been able to digest it. Both these things are good. Everything that exists in the universe is good. Absolutely. And it must be good because it is absolutely assimilable to the being that can assimilate it. Now the absolute does assimilate everything, and therefore it is all good to it. But individual human beings may have difficulty in assimilating certain things. And those things they call bad. They call them bad because that B means a house, and that is action, and that is division. That is bad that divides your substance, your house. If you could assimilate it, the same thing you would call good. on the first or fourth bridge they discovered a few years ago some microbes were eating the steel. It was good for them and bad for the bridge chappies. But they didn't know at that time that microbes could chew such things as metals, but they can and do. There is no material in the universe that is not assimilable by something. So there is no absolute evil. We have to get up from the undifferentiated volitional level through the duality of pleasure and pain up this tree of life until we find the center of reflection in here, which allows us to reaffirm the unity of the will, the duality of pleasure and pain, and the whole process of rationalizing, coordinate the three, and then we have finished the work. The enemy is a threefold enemy. We have the enemy, which is the absolute force coming through the sexual center specifically, the enemy of another force of emotion appearing as loves and hates, and the enemy of ideas derived from our ancestors. So we have three enemies. If we don't understand these three levels of enmity, we can't watch ourselves and improve our level. Now, suppose we were going to build an architecture and we were, in fact, merely volitional beings. What would we build? A volitional being as such could only surge. It couldn't do anything else. It would have no reflexive power, so that it would just build like that, infinitely. And that gives power. If you want to represent it, we would use the letter U and draw it upside down. And that symbolizes the force going that way. But it can't make anything, it just surges. It feels fine in the surging, but it doesn't make. In order to make, we have to turn. The U will have to turn round. Keep going round. In the process, it rotates and creates O. And that O travels round, so there's always in the front of that U and O. So this transition round here creates the circle. And from this we get the arc. And here is the beginning of our building, our architecture, when we have learned to rotate. So in fact the ground of all architecture is geometry. The compass, the encompassing of the zone, is the essential mark of it. Once we've got this circle, we have the principle of unity. If we look at the period when the dome did the St. Peter's Rome or St. Paul's and men's and so on. Whenever there's a dome, it means to dome. And whenever there is a dome made gross material on earth, you can spell it D-O-M if you want and leave it in there. You put a G in that dome and you get a dogma. The putting of the G into that is the ground, the gross material ideology which justifies the dome. Here's the appetite, Ma, and the ground of the potential measurement. Here is the earth. Here is the analysis of the circle. Dogma rests on this first doming. So in architecture, wherever we see a dome, we know that there is a dogma there. The church that puts a dome on it has a dogma. Some sort of formulation which, in effect, aims to circumscribe the believers. And in the act of circumscribing, to segregate the believers from what is outside. So you cannot have a church with a dome. You can't have an assembly of intelligences choosing a dome unless they intend to enclose in it the believers, and in the act of doing so to exclude, to commit to everlasting fires, those not included in the dome. Now some architectures show the dome well out of the ground, or the straight line which represents the earth, the horizontal, a dome like that. In the symbology where the circle cut in half and the bottom half is shaded. I made the bottom half a bit large tonight because I'm feeling very materialistic tonight. And this is the earth, and that is supposed to be the heaven intelligence. That's your diaphragm in the mouth.
Now, when we find a dome half out on the horizontal part of it, we know that the heaven light,
this part of it, is the idea. Here's the idea, and here's the dark will. And if we get, as we do in certain architectures, a dome in which the mass of it is sunk like that, we know that the whole being is more immersed in matter. So those architectures where the dome is manifestly sunk into this body of the building show a materialism. The being is only got just a little bit. If we consider the intelligence to be rising out of the earth, evolving, then the buildings where the dome is low, they're sticking out, we find them in some oriental buildings, we would say they're Hamitic. They are materialistic peoples who've just managed to raise the top of their crumpet or intelligence above the earth level. And if we found a dome of this order, with a lot of it sticking out, we'd say their intelligence has risen considerably over the earth line. If we find a dome like this, we'd say there's danger already in such a church of the intelligence rolling off its base. That would be dangerous. We don't want the intelligence completely severed from the body, because if we do, well then there's going to be a real separation between intelligence and gross material action. So if we remember that, we can begin to look at different architectures, different periods, different nations, and realize how much of this integrated, unific being is climbing out of the square of the earth. How much of the intelligence of that people has risen above material consideration. So the dome itself really is that circumscription. If we shade it in completely black, it is then a dogma. We just put the hard G in the middle. Now, we have another very, very common form in architecture, the pyramid. And the pyramid is originally a plane. And in the case of the Great Pyramid, the only really significant one, the others are copies, no top brick was ever put on. The top brick not being on represented the infinite absolute, not to be represented. And to remind the priest-king here that there was something to which he was subordinated as an individual being. He was in a family here. And above him was the absolute force which manifested itself in the cosmos, in the sidereal, the solar, the planetary systems, and he's only one of these things. And he has to remind himself of that fact. He's based on the earth, he's based on the base people. And the people in the mass are called base because upon them all hierarchies are raised. Hierarchy is the hieros or priest government. The flame emblem is drawn taller than the stability emblem in the triangle and appears in the Gothic. And the taller that spire went, the more it meant to say that people were aspiring, trying to get up from the earth line. This aspiration or rising of the breath, and the pyre is also the Greek for fire, for heat, because the breath is the heating principle in the body, is represented in the spires of buildings. And you notice that when the aspiration of man for matter spiritual begins to decline, then the gentlemen in the church below here, they think about it, and this needs repair up here. The wind has been blowing it, and the death watch ticker has been at it. And he looks at it, and then he thinks, well, I don't really care about the absolute in any case, so instead of repairing it, we'll cut it off. So you see some cut down like this. And after a bit, he thinks, well, why should it bother to slope at all? Next time it needs repairing, we cut it down like this. And if ever we can finally afford to build a new church, we'll build it like this, like a warehouse. Now, every architecture represents the psychology of the people who build it.
And the flat represents equality, represents democracy. So wherever you find a flat roof church, you know that there the people are all God. They're all God equally. And in the non-conformist, you know, say, there's form, and they are non-conform. They don't have that. And the result is a formlessness, a lack of hierarchy, and then, finally, a disintegration. You have a committee instead of a hierarchy, and then the absolute is crossed out as a practical proposition, and it falls down into a Sunday tea fight. And the whole meaning of the binding back the religion to the source ceases. And the end result is, of course, that the church gets wider and wider and lower until finally nobody bothers to build it. Now we've got the main types, the dome, which signifies the circumscribing, the enclosing and excluding simultaneously. We have the triangle, which symbolizes stability, and the elongated one, aspiration, and the flat roof for the equality concept. And if we look through the systems of architecture, we'll find these governing things appearing at different historical periods. And the period at which they appear is significant, and always is simply an extension of the prime architectural sign. So that if you take a given form, look at the meaning of it symbolically, you could then sit down and write the major beliefs of that period from no other data. Because it simply is the expression of the zeitgeist. The people are needing something, and the architect feels this need, and he gives them something acceptable to them. And then the result is a return to a primary geometrical structure. So once again, in this matter of the architecture, the building by the arch, we come to fundamental geometrical symbols. The more we can understand these symbols, the better for our control and for the identification of the unbreakable paper. If we write the vowels down now, E, A, R, O, U, that one is solid, that's liquid, this is heat, and these five are going to appear in our organism and in any organism. There must be a body. To make a life, there must be a body, there must be some circulation in it, there must be an animating principle, the heat in it. There must be a form of comprehension in it. That's the comprehension in it. And there must be a force going in it, nourishing it. And there must be a general principle of differentiation in it, and it must have a boundary. We've now got here seven symbols, and if we looked in certain mystical literatures, we would find a lot of the mystical writers juggling with these symbols. Every being is a being circumscribed. The original form of the letter B, the squared off form, is preceded by the circular form. This R, the rattling of the tongue, is a differentiation of this being. So every being must have a boundary. It must be internally differentiated organically. There must be a comprehensive something in it that causes all the differentiating functions not to disintegrate. It must differentiate but not disintegrate. There must be a liquid to circulate, to wash away the byproducts of action. There must be an energy or heat to make it work. It must partake in this material world. And there must be in this liquid some principles of nourishment. If
could amuse yourself by compounding some magical names out of those letters, and then you'd be surprised to find those magical names occurring in certain manuscripts.
We now have here a short way of considering particulars in relation to what we've been talking about. That letter I, which in English is the dot over the letter, and the letter has been put below it to indicate the dot. In the Hebrew, it's a yod. It's the yota of the Greeks. It's the smallest letter. And all the solids are made of particles. Tiny particles gathered together in groups. So a body of material is made of particles. But a particle is an ital part. That, of course, is a terminating meaning small, little. The part is the pyrat again, the rotation, and all rotations within the big rotation are parts. You can see the use of this term in the partial in music. Here is your fundamental, the diameter of a sphere. The sphere vibrates. The lowest note it utters is the one from its diameter. Other notes, there would be an octave on the half diameter radius, and then subsequently all the other partials, harmonics, would appear on this fundamental. And the fact that the whole being is vibrating means that all the parts are vibrating. And the fact that the whole being has its fundamental on the lowest note, has its diameter, means that the partials have higher frequencies in them. This means that if you react at the level of your perimeter, your physical body as an entity, supposing that now represents the physical body, this diameter represents your, if you like, spinal axis, then the resonance of the whole spine would give you a certain beat. And if we cut that into a certain number of steps, which symbolically have been set at 33, although there's anatomical ways of looking at it to produce a little difference, the partials along here would cause the resonances making the body resound in different ways. If you cause the whole organism to vibrate, you cause all the parts to vibrate. Now, when the whole organism vibrates, in a being as simple as an amoeba, a stimulus comes from outside and hits it, and the stimulus goes through the whole being, and the reaction goes back to the point of stimulation. And because the whole of it is involved, we call it a protopathic reaction. It is feeling in the most primordial manner, without differentiation. In a sense, we could say the amoeba has no partials. There are no subsidiary vibrations in it, no centers in it. We'll put the nucleus in because we've got to, for humility reasons. But the protoplasm in it responds totally, and therefore the amoeba can only say yes or no. You cannot consider complex relations because it hasn't got any parts. But the moment we begin to part a being, as we may part a man into three, and set up walls inside him, then we can make the dominant. You know, a third of a string is the dominant. And it allows certain changes musically from key to key, and in man from ideation, affection, and carnation. So if we're playing with the dominant, if we play C and then we play G, we can very, very quickly change from the key of C into the key of G. The fifth note, so-called, in the diatonic scale of the dominant, is really a third of the string. And in the same way, ideation is a third, and the whole man can change key on the dominant. And the way he looks at it, he can make any one of these into his dominant. Supposing we say this is the key of C, and a fifth above it is G, and a fifth below it is F. Every time we go up a fifth, we can add a sharp. Every time we go down a fifth, we can add a flat. And so we can go through all the scales up and down. Now in this case, if we want to change from our primary feeling to volition,
we have to flatten ourselves. That is to say, to change from feeling to volition, we will have to compress. Whereas if we wish to extend our ideas, we'll have to expand and become sharp. These references in the language are not accidental. They are real significances. The subdivisions and the spine of man and of the nervous system and so on are all partials of the primary egg from which he developed. He was an egg. That egg set up a division. That was then its fundamental vibration. Then it divided itself like this and got an octave here and here. And it goes on dividing a number of times until in a certain number of divisions it can make three centers. And the three center being is simply the partializing of the whole being by setting up walls of reaction. And these walls of reaction are the same thing, biologically, is signified by buffers intellectually. That is by a method of stopping a stimulus going through the whole being, we pass from a very primitive protopathic level, the level of total reaction to a stimulus, to the level where we can act partially. And like all good things, it is dangerous. Dialectics says if a thing is good, it is bad. To exactly the same measure, you have to become conscious. Volition is very, very good. It is power. It goes along. If you go through the whole thing, we could actually very, very simply catch one of these little primitive animals of the protopathic type. We just put a little pleasant stimulus here. It begins to flow towards it. We put another one a little farther and it keeps on going. After a bit, it gets a bit of inertia. Then we put something horrible there and it rushes on it before it has time to recover itself from its inertia. So if we can introduce partition into it, and in so doing isolate the stimulus, let's look again, the protopathic reaction, total stimulation, total reaction. Set a wall up there, a membrane inside. The stimulus now comes, the vibration goes so far and reacts. This part now wants to respond to the stimulus. The bottom part has been protected from the full force of the stimulus, and therefore it doesn't have to follow that part. And therefore, the being, which is now a two-brain being, can argue with itself about whether to go that way or not. If we put two stimuli on here, equal and opposite, and increase their intensity, we could cause a drift like that and a split. This is the kind of thing that happens when an egg splits. The forces that come in and split it actually come from food. It has a maximum size, and after absorbing a certain amount of food, it has absorbed a certain amount of motion and it splits to keep itself down to a workable size. But this partition is the possibility of it saving itself from a stimulus situation. And it's quite obvious that if we put four in there, we have reduced the stimulus strength to a quarter. Because now it would be confined here. And three parts can say we're not going. And if we go and make it partition into a few hundred thousand cells and put a stimulus there, it'll be confined to that corner. And consequently, the more confining internally, the more prisoning there is, the more grilling of that being, the more freedom from the external stimulus. So the question of substantializing our intellectual knowledge is the question again of taking our control idea of division, of partition, and deliberately acting upon it physically, so that we can set up these divisions inside ourselves, so that when a stimulus comes, it is isolated. Now, in the Bible, you find in Jacob's blessings, in the 49th of Genesis, the statement, Simeon and Levi digged a wall and slew a man to their own hurt. Now, the man is that cosmic man, or the egg of a human being, and Simeon and Levi signify emotions and ideas. And they cut the body with these partitions. And they made that body into little bits. And in the process, they themselves lost their unity. They were cut into little bits. Instruments of cruelty are in their habitations. Go not into them, O my soul.
the analytical working of the emotions and the ideas in the body, cut it to bits, and then the man is no good. But that's only for a time. And then it says, Joseph is a vine growing over the walls. This is your nervous system. After all the partition of the cells, Joseph starts growing over the walls, and little streams run through them, and so on. The blood system. So the vines are like the nervous system. And the blood is watering these little gardens, which have been made by sin and grievous cruelty. Now, to equate ideas and emotions with cruelty isn't very difficult if you remember that an idea is going to analyze, and an emotion is an outspringing motion of the feeling. It's really a reaction. And if you don't get rid of this perturbatic reaction, an emotion could commit you totally into a situation from which there would be no escape. And the form of the reverberation here from the stimulus is the idea. So there is the idea, and there is your emotion, the reaction to the idea. And it would commit you totally into a situation, and then you might be lost utterly. Therefore, the emotions are cut into bits, and the ideas, which are simply the formal activity of the substance, are likewise. So Simeon and Levi slew a man to their own hurt. But Joseph throws over his vines over the walls, the nervous system grows, and links together all the separated cells and all the organs, and integrates them in the body. So the whole of the organism of a man, his totality, his field, is cut into sections, and then the vine grows over the sections to link them. The linkage system in the body is done with gaps. There's a cell going down, and another one here. There's no continuous line from the brain to a muscle, because if there were, the energy in the brain would leak perpetually down that nerve and make the body act all the time. By means of a system of little gaps, the synapses here, a resistance exists, so that when from the brain center a force goes down, it can't jump that gap, and therefore the body cannot respond. And if you want to make it jump the gap, you have to make an effort of will. And the act of making an effort of will forces more energy down the nerve, it piles up here, and then it jumps the gap. And in the process, it lights up. You see fun little ideas in these synapses when you've done them to practice, even visually. The more you use a certain nerve, the lower that resistance gets. And these things tend to approximate together. So that when you're using these nerve lines, the resistance is becoming less and less, and they may become so low in resistance, which we represent here by distance, that in effect it doesn't require your conscious willing to cause the energy to flow down. And you then have a permanent habit. Now, it's easier to make a habit than to undo it, because you can make it by conscious effort of will, the energy derived from food, plus a governing concept, forcing it down. And you have a resistance to overcome. But when the thing has grown and the resistance is very, very low, so that it's below conscious level, you can't even begin to find out where to undo the effort. And therefore you need a system of contra-efforts. There's a system of exercises of contra-efforts. This is the guiding idea behind Gurdjieff's dance movements. To break this natural flow of habitual nervous energy running down across very, very low resistances. When we come back to the three-part man, we can see that the isolation of the five senses in the head here, the section of the general sensitivity of the skin to touch, causes the isolation of sense data in the head. So the data can then be rotated in the head before they are let down into the emotional center. But, again, dialectically, there's always a danger for every virtue you may acquire. Once you've got the sense data rotating in the head, if you're not careful, they'll go on rotating in the head, and you may know many, many things, but if you don't know that they must be translated into action through emotion, you'll just become an intellectual.
So we have to take all the good ideas, the ideas to which we give our will. Good doesn't mean anything else. We must not have any erroneous moral ideas about the will. That is good to which the will commits itself in any individual. So if a man commits himself to the ideas, it is good. And if it's that man committing his will to pure intellectualism, it is good. But he's already made a judgment that this will subserve his life in some way. And at certain historical periods, we won't go back to the architecture, but you can see the evidences. Say when the dome is there, which is this O, comprehension rules. So there'll be an intellectual comprehendingness and a stress on this cleverness of the head, this dome. And then you'll find the scholastics will be waving themselves merrily in the breeze with their learning, and yet it won't get down here. And therefore there must arise a reaction from the rest of the body. And the historical reactions, the revolutions, and the radical movements that occur are only reactions to partial activities, which have been torn out of the context of the fundamental. It's just that in the same way as if we took a string off your double bass and said, well, we're going to play not the open string, the fundamental, we're going to play an octave higher, but we don't want the whole string, so we'll cut it off. Something would happen to the quality of the tone, necessarily. So, in the same way, if you cut the head off and play your partial, the intellect, something happens to the tone. Tone is T1. It's a unity principle. Your unity is destroyed. To make your unity be restored, you must take your sense data and have the courage to emote about them. And actually it's taboo today to emote about anything. Scientific objectivity, the most comic of recent myths, is the rule. And it induces this dreadful intellectualism. We must learn to emote about the idea, that is to feel so strongly our yes and our no to each idea we've got, that we feel it building up in us and trying to express itself. Either to build it or to knock it down. It must say yes or no. And when it has started that feeling, it will move into the generative department, and it will either make children to embody that idea, or it will make works of art or build large buildings or something. The important point is that once Simeon and Levi have divided us, and that we exist now proves they have, we have to get Joseph throwing his vines over the wall, which is making these connections through the spinal nerves intellectually, to see the reason why we must integrate. And when we've seen the reason why we must integrate, then we must go on to the feeling center, because the whole being is the field being, and the parts are modalities of the field. The intellect, volition, are both parts of feeling. Feeling mobilized is volition. Feeling formulated is idea. The whole man is simply a field of operation. Power is operating in the unifield, the absolute. And wherever it rotates, it makes a finite being. And that finite being is the authority for his own field. And his own field is defined by how far he can extend his influence. So he talks about the field of his activity. It may be that a man hasn't got enough initiative and authority over his own physical body for him to have much control over his field. If he hadn't, some other being stronger will invade his territory with his authority, and like a surgeon will come along and cut pieces off him. And in so doing, he's actually justified by success. There is another justification. When he operates from his superior power, he defines. And the passive one, whatever he does, is not justified by the stronger. If he complains, if he has that much energy, he's justified.
to complain. But he'd need more energy than complaint energy to stop the process and assert his own positivity right up to the edge of his field. But you remember from a diagram of the six. I think I'd better do this so that nobody thinks we're exceeding them with sleight of hand. When we draw the circle, I think we ought to sharpen the point of this one there.
We'll soften them. Right.
This is called hardboard. When we cut this non-arbitrarily, in this manner, and wind around the board, it always cuts into six. This is derived from the word existence. Existence, existere, means made out of six, because every being actually has six other beings contending with it for the authority of its zone. These are fighting words, partner. It means, in effect, that if a man is not on his own centre, giving out the energies to control his own field, he will be subjected, in fact, to the field of other beings. If we extended this infinitely in all directions, we would give a plane diagram of reality. Reality is simply points of impulsion throughout infinity, and each point is beating. If I had my mechanical beater with me, I'd show you how it does it. Each point is beating and asserting its own authority. All points are equally points. This is the basis of Lincoln's democracy. And nevertheless, there is no reason why any given point should beat its own message. It is an act of will to do that, and will is prior to intellection. If this one beats very, very hard, he can strengthen his own perimeter. And all the other forms within him, these six forms, which don't belong to him, because they're the perimeters of six other beings, he incorporates in his beings, and he makes five senses and a mind. You see the doctrine of subsidiary entities in here. Why we have entities other than ourselves in us? Because they don't belong to us. And this is why we have to order them about. Because if we don't, they'll order us about. Another being, seeing our perimeter going very, very strong here, is thrown into a disequilibrium. This line is weak. This one is very, very strong. So, this particular being might be very, very loud and make his perimeter become very, very strong. And there are two beings fighting. These two beings are fighting for the dominion of as far as they can get. These are very fighting words, really. If this being elevates itself to the point of obscuring this, then it is right. It is the author. The owl tor. You see? The energy going to establish a law, which is a relative function. An author is the primary energy going to establish a law of its own. The law is exactly as far as its own perimeter and no farther. So there's a real fight going on throughout the whole of infinite space between all entities. And a long time ago, one entity won a colossal battle, the result of which is the universe. And all the subsidiary beings in it, these things, this lovely six-petal lotus, yeah, these are subsidiary entities of this one. All these are inscribed in the big universe. Supposing this particular one is a being with which I am identified. I'm a lenticular being. If I accept the definition, I am a lenticular being, one of six, inner sevens, if I accept it, I affirm it. And in the act of accepting and affirming that thing, I have limited my consciousness to it. And I have imposed upon myself I am the arbiter of my destiny when I accept a concept that limits me. Supposing I start doing a bit of geometry like Pythagoras did and Plato and one or two other fellows. That's funny, you know. If I take that curve of mine and try to find out its source, where does it come from? It goes round there, it goes round there. It's mine. So if this one is mine, I'm not a lenticular being. I'm a nice big circular being. And inside this circular being, there are some other beings. In other words, I wasn't a lenticular being at all. I really was a seventh being, an S even, a spiritual even being. And I've got six lenticular beings inside me by changing my concept. This is exactly what happens inside human societies. When one man with a governing concept like that defines some other men without the concept as the people. And he puts a crown on himself. Nobody else did. And by imposing on them a certain idea called the borlot, or hot ball, as it should be correctly pronounced, he persuaded them that they had voted him in. He was a cunning man. And because they believe that this is an essential part of their well-being as lenticular beings, they support it. And he doesn't allow them to know that the curve of this lenticular being really belongs to this being. He keeps this lenticular being here only a little sixer or sex being. Six and sex are the same. He puts them in sections and deprives them of their wholeness. If he could become himself aware by extending his not merely a king, he says, I think I'll capture that king and make him a little king, and I call myself an emperor. I'm going to extend my dominion to include a colossal zone. If he conquered to infinity, which is impossible, he would be an infinite emperor. Actually, he conquers so far until he's too far away from base, and then another center far away is nearer to itself than he is, and is stronger, and that is the limit of his empire. But it is an act of will and an act of deliberate integration around a concept that determines. So in the same way that the protopathic in the same way that we avoid the protopathic reaction in this diagram by departmentalizing the egg, so in this diagram we avoid the protopathic reaction by seeing the segments inside ourselves. We learn to distinguish between the five senses and the common sense, which is the mind. And we see the great gaps between the senses, between hearing and seeing, which are two different frequency bands. There's a blank, full of frequencies that we do not respond to normally. If we responded totally to all frequencies, we would be blinded completely. The whole organism would then be confused. By means of introducing gaps between the different frequency bands, we liberate ourselves from the absolute. If, theologically, the absolute had been satisfied to be absolute, it would not have created. The fact that it has created shows a virtue in gaps. It's a virtue in not knowing certain things. There are untold fantasies between the five senses. We don't want to know about those until we have completely understood the meaning of the five senses. And only when we have substantialized ourselves in these five senses and their coordinate to the mind, are we ready to turn it a little and find out what is inside here. Then we build up the 12-fold system, which we see symbolized in the zodiac. We can build it up to the Sahasrara, the 1,000-petal lotus. It simply means, as we become more and more conscious of the real meaning of the limitations of the senses we already have, so we can gain the one thing we need, courage, to dare to face what's in between the two senses. It needs courage, because the unknown is between there. It could be damaging, it could be frightening, it could be disintegrating. When we know thoroughly the five senses and the coordinating mind, then we can begin to realize what must be the nature of the vibrations between seeing and hearing, tasting and touching, and tasting and smelling. There are other levels of awareness between these five separated senses. And when we have grounded ourselves in the significance of the senses, then we can turn the wheel a bit and generate organs for perceiving the interspaces. In the same way that this room is full of radio waves, and by means of a radio set we can abstract them. But if that same device had been invented too early, it would have frightened people tremendously. Today we can understand it because of certain electrical and mechanical concepts that we have, which make it safe to do such things. The more we understand, the more we can afford to know about the gaps in reality. In order to do it, we must cut ourselves, and just as we cut ourselves into the three parts, making the ideation, the affection, and the conation, so we must divide ourselves down the middle into the right and the left. On the left side, we put ideas in general, and on the right side, will in general. The right side of the body and the left side receive nervous impulses in a different way. In a right-handed man, volition tends to express itself in the right hand. In the left-handed man, volition has been diverted into ideation. So left-handed means cunning. If you look in the laws of Manu, you will find that the castless Chandalas were forbidden to write with the right hand, because it was the will side. And if you know, the rule is, they shall not write from the left to the right, nor with the right hand. Because if they do, they will become more willful, harder to control. That's the Brahmin rule, to stop the Chandavas coming into the caste system. So you see, these physiological facts have been known a long time, and they're still useful for us to realize that the body is unequal. When Jacob fights with an angel, one of his hip joints is put out, because he's fighting with will and ideas. There is one eye in the head, volitional, one eye, ideation. Gurdjieff says on one occasion, thou shalt not look into the left eye of a woman. Now, if you consider the nature of woman as volitional, and therefore the suppression of the ideational in her, and you look into the ideational eye, you're looking into nothing. If you meditate on the meaning of that, you'll find it has a very definite relation to the dynamics of the will in a woman, because on the left eye she's unprotected, because she hasn't got an idea. If you look into the right eye, you look into her will, and she can respond at the will level. But if you look into this eye, where you expect unconsciously to see ideation, you are in danger of the abyss. You're in danger of the unformulated. You could become passive by thinking you are active. And really, it's the orientation of ideas to will in the being that causes this attraction of the sexes and of the two poles of the same being. So when we look at the head as intellective, we can see the head considering volition, the head considering form, feeling about volition, feeling about ideas, volition, ideas. And the spinal column itself divides the body in half, not quite symmetrically because of the inequality, because we are more volitional than we are rational. A being that was entirely rational would have only a left side. A being that's more rational than willful is left-handed. The Levites, from whom the priests are left-handed. And because they were left-handed, or idea men, the will has been played into the idea, they are tricky. And the rule was, as they are naturally tricky, we'd better give them a job for tricky men, and we'll know where they are, they'll be in the church. And then we'll keep an eye on them. Now, there is a four-caste system in India, the Brahmins, or priests, the Kshatriyas, or warriors, and the businessmen and the servants. Now, this fourfold division corresponds with the four parts of man. And the Brahmins, who are the sons of Abraham, and of whom many were left-handers, imposed upon the others an idea. But after a time, the strong men amongst them, the Kshatriyas, the warriors, discovered that any time there was any trouble, the Brahmins called them, and they began to think. So then they said, if we can fight the enemies of the Brahmins, we can fight the Brahmins. So they rose against them and overthrew them. And then we find the great period of the Karma Yogi. The king, the activist, takes over the ideas of the Brahmin and restores the will to its primacy. The Brahmin has put the idea over the will, like the Dominicans put the idea over the will, like Francis put the will over the idea. So Thomas Aquinas put the idea over the will. And there's a real battle between intellectualists and volitional men. The intellectualists, because their will was not very strong, put it into ideas and tried to think of a technique to overcome volitional men. And this process is called the murdering of Abel by Cain. The canny man, the man of ideas, didn't like the success that manifestly attended volition, so he began to think how to destroy will. His first act was to kill Will suddenly in the field. And the next thing to do, because Will unfortunately had already procreated and was already in Cain on the volitional side, even Cain's children, some of them were volitional. And they argued with Daddy. So Daddy set up a system so that all new wills coming into the world should be put through the strainer, or trainer. And thereby the will would become strained, sieved, and come out in little bits, which are called ideas. This is the conditioning of the will, which would have been unific, but then became disintegrated, and in the conditioning of its reflexes, entirely subject to its educators. So we see that this battle goes on eternally. This is the father, the will. This is the son, the idea. The battle between the two produces life, the Holy Spirit. And the idea is the limitation of the will, because an idea is only generated when the will compresses itself onto a center. An idea is the compressed center of the field when the will is turned inwards to that center. And therefore the idea is a restriction upon the will. Nevertheless, we have to work through ideas because they're forms. Screwdriver is better for a screw than a hammer. So the idea has a certain amount of significance that must not be ignored, and the will has no significance at all. But it is the power that drives the significance. Significance is in the form. And in the volition is the power that actuates the significance of the idea. So inside any individual man there is Cain, the idea side, there is Abel, the volitional side, and the idea is always tending to kill the will. But if you understand that the will cries for vengeance from the blood centered in the heart, which is the feeling life, and that God forgave Cain, and that there's a process called raising Cain going on in the universe. The raising of Cain is the clarification of the idea of the primary schism between the will and the idea. So that when we finally understand the real split between will and idea, Cain has been raised and Abel has been avenged. Because the idea raised is Abel. Ability comes out of the idea elevated. And the ability compressed gives the idea. So these two processes are going on continuously in the universe as power and form, in the individual as will and idea. They have produced as idea the separation into the three parts, and as will are unifying the three parts, And the feeling awareness, the field awareness, is that through which we gain the power consciously to win, to use its power as far as it can. There is no reason whatever why one should press harder than another, but the observed fact in the universe is that some do press harder than others, and the ones who press harder than the others are called the activists, and the ones that they act upon are called passivists. And there is nothing to distinguish between them in any ethical or moral sense. This is entirely beyond moral or ethical concepts. This is the beyond good and evil of Nietzsche. It's the beyond the black and the white of the yogis. This is simply a statement of fundamental dynamics. The absolute, represented by the paper, is able to vibrate. It does so throughout itself, absolutely. At every point of impulsion, there is generated a travelling motion of expulsion. But around it, there are always more and more points of impulsion expulsion. The pattern can only come by the interlapping of all these forces. And the original state called heaven is when all these forces are vibrating at the same intensity. So there is absolutely no hierarchy whatever. That is the state to which ultimately it returns, when it says no man shall teach God to other men because all shall know him. Meanwhile, we are in the condition where some beings of great strength have imposed upon us a concept of our affinity, of our partiality, of our inferiority in doing within their definition. Inferior simply means doing within their definition. If we work within their definition, we are practically inferior to them. And if we work outside their definition, we are superior to them. And it is only in this definition and the acceptance or rejection of the definition that there is any freedom for us. Is there any particular question at the moment about this primary diagram that is obscure? Remember, every man is imposing on every other man already. The question is, to what end?
Mind is the common sense.
The common sense, common to the pioneer.
Yes.
It simply means that we fed in from five of these separate messages and used one of these for overlapping it, for comparing.
I see.
It's common sense. It's a sense like the protopathic reaction of an amoeba. So that all the separated vibrations have a zone wherein they overlap, so that we can actually think how a sound might look. We can think what a smell or a touch signifies to us. We can try to find out the meaning of the emotions in relation to sound stimuli. Because we have a protoplasmic part, a part that has not been spoiled, a part that has not been simmioned and needed, and we use it as a mixing bowl for the separated messages of the other parts.
Gee, is there a significance of parts of the universe imposing itself upon others? Why? Either because the forces are coming unequally or differently?
Why is a psychological question. You already imply an intelligent being there. In why? Why are we used for psychological questions? How is a mechanical question. The how is perfectly simple. Somewhere there's a beat stronger than somewhere else.
Yeah.
That's the how. Yeah. To say why is to postulate a rational being. And here we come to the concept of the monistic God. This diagram could be extended infinitely. And it is this diagram and all its significance, infinitely extended, that Christ refers to as God when he said, my Father. But when he says, I, he's referring to a circle. When he says I judge correctly, he's referring to the biggest circle that is, the Max Recovery one. When he says, when I judge correctly, he's made a shift of reference. When he says, I have not come to judge, he's referring to his finite terrestrial. But when he says, my father works and I work, he's talking about the macrocosmic, the individuated, and the common energy running through both. And he shifts his reference all the time. This is what parable does. Parable is specially made to release you from misconceptions of groove thinking. Parable jolts you. It makes you think in another way. A lot of parables have become platitudes and are now groove thinkings. But if you work on them, like the parable of the sower and so on, in relation to the body, that some seed falls on good ground, some falls on stony ground, somewhere there's not much earth, and so on. All this applies to parts of this fourfold being. And therefore, there is certain good ground in you. Well, good refers to this. If a seed falls into your will, it will do all right. There's also shallow ground. It falls in there, springs up very quickly in a brightly mark, and is gone. These parables can be recharged with their original significance by work and by activation upon them, by actually testing them in action.
Can this be known in degree then? Say the imposition of somebody else's emotion and restrain that to you. Say you, figuratively speaking, you can run through that emotion, see the cause of it, and not allow it to cause.
Yes, that's right. Then you're upsetting.
The time you would stop it would be, say that's beyond the perimeter somewhere. But yeah. Then that must be in a degree and a different level, because it seems flat.
Yes. My understanding is wrong there, you see that. But it means to say, if I'm going to meet an imposition
somewhere,
that is
the limit. But the second
time I see through that. If you've seen through it, you must have
penetrated it. But then it still keeps flowing in
that direction. But it can't influence you.
It can influence somebody else.
That's all right, that's their business. Many are called and few chosen. Everybody would like power, but few are chosen to get it. And you have to think about who does the choosing. Many are called and few chosen. Everybody would like power, but few are chosen to get it. And you have to think about who does the choosing. There's a great mystery in who does the choosing.
And it means to say that you can thread your way through that.
Yes. Yeah.
If possible.
Oh, yeah.
Many times, just thread your way through that and not be touched.
Not be touched at all. It's entirely a question of what concept you will. A man gives you an idea. If you accept that idea from him, in effect, you are his instrument. For instance, school teachers in general who are trained to teach the three R's to children and who do so for the whole of their lives are just as if they were mechanisms belonging to the government. They're simply an extension of the government. The few men who constitute the government have appropriated those bodies and used those bodies to impose on the children coming up. With a handful of educators, Hitler turned the Jewish children into Jew haters, into little Nazis. First he got a handful of educators, imposed on them an idea. And they were really exactly like Pavlov's dogs. They responded in a conditioned reflex manner. And then they're put into the schools. And in one generation, suddenly there's a total change of mood. And one man had imposed. And this danger is going on all the time. Either individual centres are self-determinant, able to resist it, or they are not. If they are not, they are going to be imposed upon. If we in this room are working now, it is to stop other beings imposing on us.
But you see these centres?
Yeah.
They can be known in death.
In death. They are the beings. Each one of those centres, as far as we're concerned, is another intelligence.
I'm trying to get that in the picture. It seems that this is a point, a non-existent point. It must be seen in death too.
It isn't non-existent because no point can be non-existent at all. You're talking about Euclid's abstract points which have location without dimension. That is meaningless.
I'm not intellectualizing on this, you know. I can't get a picture of it.
All you have to do is look upon your physical body as a condensation of certain forces modulized in the manner we call material. Now, when you, in that place, the white of you in that place, refer to the modalities in that place, you say, my body. But when you refer to the I in you, you are referring to the same I that I am referring to. If you're referring to consciousness. But if you refer to a conceptual being, the one your educators taught you to be, and you call that I, well then it's a misstatement. It's a false identification. It's a group concept that's been put into your body from outside and has been imposed on the consciousness where your body is. Your body is one of those points, a three-dimensional one. The other bodies in this room are other points.
But it's still like the figure of the lung body. And this is the depth I'm trying to get at. From birth to death.
Well, what you're talking about now are certain organic changes in the reference point in consciousness. A body coheres for a purpose, for a time. When the purpose and the time have expired, they are released. And the elements that were held together for that time by a will disintegrate. The elements do. But the consciousness does not disintegrate. But the vehicle has disintegrated because its time has been fulfilled. Everybody is a volitional vehicle.
Yes, but at times, say for instance, my floggingness, you know, it's extremely difficult to me, yet it's extremely interesting too. It seems all my ideas and all the perimeter of the unknown around me, see, that keeps changing.
It must do, because there are other beings.
Well, that's what I mean by death.
But there are other beings. I'm one.
Of course.
Everyone else in the room is one. There's some more outside, all beating their own centres and propagating concepts. Somewhere in a certain school in England, recently formed, there's a small group of men determined to dominate the world and to subdue all scientific brains for their ends. They think they're going to succeed, and unless there's a counterstroke to them, they will. But there are many counterstrokes to their activities all over the world already. Because when a stimulus comes in one point, the ripple goes to all other points. And those other points can say, it's within their power, I will now initiate a counter-ripple. Those that don't will be jammed between these two. It's essential to be very realistic about that. I can work, a decision can be made here, by this I. I work on me. I say me because that's substantial, the M is substance. The I refers to this observer. I work on me, this observer works on body, substance. Wherever there's a body, there is consciousness working on it. Wherever the form in the body is such that consciousness can use it in a certain way, it will do so. But that depends on the organization of the body. So if the body has a very low organization, like an amoeba, it won't join in the conversation. But if the body is sufficiently organized, it can see what it means to get a governing concept, to emote it, to volitionalize it, to put it into the material world, so that another center with a similar purpose cannot reduce to inferiority, that is, to an internal element in his definition, with being. An angel came to William Blake on one occasion and said, do you know that you're worshipping the most horrible, stinking kind of heaven that looks like hell? And he took Blake and showed him a horrible place. And Blake said, all right, let's now go to heaven. And when they went up to heaven, Blake said, now look at that. And the angel saw some horrible things, the monkeys picking each other's tails, and a terrible smell. And the angel said, you're imposing on me. And Blake said, we impose on each other. Now, that was a psychological statement by a psychologist in his day, far superior to any psychologist since.
Nietzsche's psychology is a baby compared with Blake's. Blake was a very powerful man. And he said, if I don't make a system of my own, I will be enslaved by the system of somebody else. But a system is only a savior for a time. At the end of it, you have to do something else. Because your concept must be pushed out to infinity, because it's infinity that other beings conceptualize it. And it's either or. Their concept includes us. A world ruler includes us in his idea, as forms. The question is, are we going to accept the definition? Some friends of mine at the moment in jail in Germany did not accept the definition. They went to jail. They're better off. They've got quite good literature to read, and they'll be out eventually, after they've done their token service. Meanwhile, they've been contaminating the other prisoners. The whole thing depends on this development of a master concept and then pushing it because somebody else is pushing it at the other end. This is the meaning of the opposition Christ and the devil. God is no respecter of persons. He gives energy to Christ, and he gave energy to the devil too, because he said, if I'm going to develop my muscle, I must have something to pick up. You cannot develop without opposition. Blake said opposition is true friendship. And therefore, a thinker like Nietzsche said, I am absolutely against the church, and therefore I must do everything I can to keep it in existence, because I must have something to attack. And it's a very, very bad policy if a government were to eliminate its enemies completely. It would have to introvert and attack itself. So what it has to do is make skirmishes against the enemy, make a token war, and then stop it. Germany shall not rise again. Oh no. But at the end, they have to be kept in me. And it's fundamental psychology. If you once eliminate your enemy, you will die. Because life is opposition.
It's resistance. See that?
And therefore, in order to develop, you must find your opposition. And in a city where everybody's trained to be polite, it isn't easy to find it. You must hit it on the right level. If you've gone past the bludgeon level, then don't hit it with a bludgeon. Hit it at the level at which you get most benefit.
I should think that words have hurt some people much more than a blow.
Well, you're fighting on an intellectual level.
But sometimes it might be necessary for the blow.
Maybe. Well, only sensitivity can say
that. Yes. You know this third eye and the balance of the soul?
Yeah.
I'm interested in that right now. What is seen in the balance of things. Say, for instance, you're puzzling over something, say, the mix up everywhere, jumping from one crisis to another. You try to reason these things out as much as possible. Then you get certain moments of clarity, and you get pictures, these titles. What's the relation of these pictures to things? I've got my own interpretation for them.
The pictures are a visual idea.
But there's no relation to them, coordinate. At least that there's nothing in the outside world that could.
Well, that doesn't mean much. The outside world contains a very, very minute portion of your total form. And your total form stretches back through the germ plasm through all your ancestors. Right back to the very, very first little bit of protoplasm that ever occurred into the universe. And beyond that, to cosmic force. We're only claiming our own when we claim the absolute, because every single one of those points is as valid as all the others. No one has the right to impose on us if we have the right to stop them. Fundamentally, their might is right. Have you got the willpower? Have you got the clarity to know what to mean?
In these pictures, is it necessary to put them into words?
If you don't, you will not order them. And the person who has put them into words will impose on you. In the history of the
development of ethical and moral theory, the first thing that happened was the setting up of a series of definitions, the teaching of people to recite boundaries, rights, obligations, such words. When they have been engrammed upon them, then other names are appended, and gradually the mind was furnished with definitions. The men who made those definitions wrote their names upon certain territories which they had defined, and then everybody else kept off them because it said, up to this mark is mine. That's exactly what happened historically. So the Nietzsche, in writing The Genealogy of Morals, can say, some men, once upon a time, first imposed words on the world, and then they imposed facts through the word on people. And he divides the world into men that are consciously defining and men that are suffering their definition. What he demands, really his Superman, is a man that throws away all the concepts that other men have imposed upon him and finds his unique nature and develops it.
In words.
You can't do it any other way. Change the word, you change the idea. In Indian philosophy, you'll find nama rupa, name form, is one concept. Change the name, you change the form. Change the form, you change the function. If you haven't got a word, you haven't got really the clear form. If you haven't got that, you haven't got the function.
That's like coming on an influence that you think would be beneficial for you.
That's right. Choose your influence. Choose your concept, which you will serve. I serve a concept. His worship is perfect freedom. That's what it says in the Bible. God. His worship is perfect freedom. That's a nice concept.
And when you're under the influence of something, I mean to say that this is the resistance, the clarification emerges, the resistance to say, well, these things will pass, I'll wait for the other. At such times, you must be passive.
Well, you would have to be actively passive if you waited deliberately. Not passively passive.
No.
Christ is talking about active passivity when he talks about deliberately getting crucified instead of accidentally. That's converting the passive into an active by deliberately doing it.
Yes.
That's a transvaluation of values. Previously, everybody had suffered because men were stronger than they were, and they didn't like it. He said to them, the only reply to the men who dominate you is not to run away. It's to say, right, bang the nail in, Samuel. You haven't touched me. There's a Russian saying, when you bang it in, you haven't touched my soul. I still disagree with you. Once that had been done, people saw that it was possible to annoy their rulers by the way they took their punishment. And suddenly a new cult came, martyrdom. They were delighted. You throw them to the lions. Instead of cowering down and giving enjoyment to the wicked rulers, they just looked at them. So there's something in me that your lions can't bite. And the rulers recognized it and said, that's how we rule. And so, when the fishes were fishing on one side of the boat and got no fish, Christ said, throw the net on the right side. That's the rulers. Not the left wing. And then all the rulers, the kings, and the monarchs and so on were converted. Because they'd recognized the spirit. And when Constantine saw the sign of the cross in Oxygnolincus, in the sign of new triumph, because the deliberate affirmation of a negation posits a negation and inverts its nature and deprives the enemy of the sole satisfaction he got. Namely, that from seeing you as inferior to his purpose. That's the umvertum calaverter. Turn the whole thing upside down. It's very easy to do on somebody. He thinks you're in an inferior position. A friend of mine, an actor, he's being produced. He thinks the producer's a fool. He's got totally the wrong idea. He's in a great rage about it. He's not going to take it. I said, let us pretend that the absolute is the producer. When you say this, think of the absolute. The producer is always right. But you must think of the absolute. And then I want you to go to the producer, and when he says this silly thing again, say, looking up, the producer is always right. You will be referring to the absolute. He will think you mean him. And see what happens. The result was the producer didn't know what to do with himself. Suddenly he felt that his authority was being accepted without resentment. But he loves resentment. It's his only evidence of power. So he took him out to dinner afterwards and said, is something wrong? And he said, no. And he tried all through dinner to find out what was the matter with him. And it cost him at least a dinner. Because you have no satisfaction unless you can annoy somebody and get them to resent you and then impose on them.